Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Randu Gaw and Heather Fowler. Today, we are excited to feature Craig Santos Perez, author of Habitat Threshold, published by Omnidon Publishing in 2020.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a pretty cozy idea. Today, we are drinking a deep bluocene inspired by Craig's poetry collection. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
For those not familiar with Craig's work, Craig Santos Perez is a professor in the English department at the University of Hawaii, Manoa, where he teaches creative writing, eco-poetry, and Pacific literature. He is affiliate faculty with the Center for Pacific Island Studies and the Indigenous Politics Program. He served as chair of the Hawaiian, Asian, and Pacific Islanders Board in the Office of General Education from 2017 to 2020, and as the director of the creative program from 2014 to 2016 and 2019 to 2020. He earned a BA from the University of Redlands, an MFA in creative writing from the University of San Francisco, and an MA and PhD in comparative ethnic studies from the University of California, Berkeley. He is a poet, scholar, editor, publisher, essayist, critic, book reviewer, artist, environmentalist, and political activist. Of his recent book, Habitat Threshold, we will hear from and about today. Jonathan Skinner, poet, editor, and founder of Ecopoetics, says of Perez's work, exquisite in his attention, the placement of words for power, beauty, and insight. Perez raises poetry to earth magnitude. His pastorals, odes, sonnets, recycling, lullabies, and chants sing plainly and with great precision of the vast and intricate inequalities in and through which world ecology enmeshes us. These are songs of protest, but also love songs for family, place, plant, and animal. Such beautiful, strong praise. I can't even tell you how excited I am that we have an eco-poet on the show today.
I am too. Habitat Threshold is a timely collection of eco-poetry. In it, Perez looks at his ancestry as a native Pacific Islander and the ecological plight of his homeland. His book progresses from the birth of his daughter as she grows in a world of climate change, toxic waste, animal extinction, global capitalism, and mass migration. The personal is the political in these poems, as Perez explores lost habitats and the future we are creating for ourselves. This collection, which includes a range of poetic form, haiku, sonnets, free verse, prose poems, urges readers to reconcile their responsibility for the world as it is today, while envisioning a future that is better, sustainable, more loving.
How are you feeling today, Craig?
Oh, I'm so honored to be here. Thank you both for having me. I'm excited to talk about the book and to drink some cocktails with everybody.
Woo! Well, today we are so looking forward to talking to you about your work and having you give us a reading a little bit later. Is giving live readings something you enjoy?
Oh, yes. I definitely love hearing poetry out loud and connecting with live audiences. Usually in person, but over the last year over Zoom.
Yeah, we've had some authors talk about Zoom. It's quite a different environment, don't you think?
Yes, it's so strange to just see little squares on my laptop and not actually see everybody's faces and feel their energy. But I'm still thankful to be able to connect with people during times of social distancing.
Yeah, and you know, it's so funny because I was planning on asking you anyway, because I can totally imagine that you have kind of a diverse readership, being the types of topics that you write on. Who usually attends your readings? And do you think that maybe being in this pandemic or with the Zoom environment has caused more audience to be able to come and listen when you give a reading?
Great question. Well, I've been lucky enough to travel around the world to give readings across the US, here in the Pacific, in Asia, and parts of Europe. And my audiences usually consist of students, other poets, academics, environmentalists. And I've been lucky now over Zoom to connect to an even more international audience. And so, you know, I'm just grateful for anyone who reads my book, to be honest, and happy to engage with different kinds of audiences.
Yeah, that sounds like such a fruitful place for cross collaboration and kind of like cross disciplinary conversations too. I'm sure that that's something that happens a lot with your work.
So definitely, you know, with eco-poetry, so much of its mission is to show the interconnectedness of people, animals, and ecologies. And so being able to connect with people around the world, I think definitely speaks to that global interconnectedness that we all need to be more aware of.
And do you feel that, I think you sort of said something about the Zoom format has brought some new readers to your work, maybe you might not have found before this?
Yeah, definitely. Living in Hawaii, being one of the most isolated landmasses on Earth, it makes it difficult to travel. And so over the past year, I've been able to Zoom into the Singapore Writers Festival, the Dodge Poetry Festival out in New York. I was able to connect with a environmental writing class in Switzerland. And next month, I'm actually Zooming into a university in Norway. And these are places I would never be able to travel to in real life. And so it's nice to have this different kind of virtual connection with people and places.
Very cool. Now, you also do scholarly work. How do your interests intersect, or how do poetry and academic writing function together in your life?
Well, definitely poetry is a nice break from the academic writing.
Yes, I can imagine.
Where I don't have to worry about citations and footnotes and research, even though some of that does creep into my poetry. But a lot of my academic research focuses on Pacific Islander literature, eco-criticism, and so the study of how the environment is represented in literature. And so it's been a great journey to be able to do both the critical and creative work and to work interdisciplinarily. And I'm also an educator, so I love being in the classroom and being able to teach my students both how to write an eco-poetry, eco-poem, but also how to read and interpret eco-novel or something.
Yeah,
very neat. Yeah, Habitat Threshold has so many strong poems in different formats. So it's funny you mentioned that because I noticed it right off the bat. I was like, I see these footnotes here. This has a very scholarly energy here in the Borders poem, for example. And I really like how the book inserts that kind of scholarly poetic energy and plays with forms. I want you to speak to, if you can, what attracted you to form poetry in a time when it's maybe not quite so popular as it had been in the past? And how do you feel it functions in your work?
Great question. When I was writing this book, I was thinking a lot about different ecologies and different forms in nature. And so it inspired me to think of that in terms of language and poetry, to think about the different forms that poets have developed over the years and over the centuries even. And so I wanted to have in this book a what we might call an aesthetic diversity to match or reflect the biodiversity of the planet. And so I wanted each poem, every time a reader turned a page, to encounter a new kind of linguistic ecology or a new kind of literary form as a way to embody kind of exploring different ecologies in nature.
Wow. I see that, though. I see it on the page.
Awesome.
Can you tell us about the poems in Habitat Threshold and how the book fits in with your author trajectory?
Yes. So this is my fifth book of poetry. Mm-hmm. My earlier four books are actually part of a longer series of books called From Unincorporated Territory. And that series is all about my home island of Guam, which is in the Western Pacific. And as some listeners might know, it's an unincorporated territory of the United States. And so in those series of books, I write a lot about my native culture, growing up on a Pacific island, as well as kind of some of the politics of Guam and of the larger Pacific. Now, this new book is very different in the sense that I'm also writing about Hawaii, where I've been living for 10 years. Writing about other planetary issues, because of course, ecological issues are not just local, but also global. And this book is also composed of a lot of formal poetry, which I haven't done much of in my earlier books, and a lot of shorter poems too. A lot of my earlier books are, because they're all connected, they're all kind of longer serial poems. And so it's a big departure for me in terms of form. and content in some ways, but it's connected in the earlier books in the sense that it's still discussing environmental and political issues grounded in the Pacific.
Interesting.
Yeah, fascinating. And how fun that is too, right? When there's different projects have different demands and allow you to be playful in different ways. That's great. So here's a two-part question for you. Did you always imagine you'd be a poet? And what for you, you mentioned you had that kind of series of books in that other style, and then this one, which departed from that somewhat. What usually informs your decision toward a new collection or a new, even a new book of literary criticism? What's on your in channel, quote unquote, for inspiring new material?
Well, definitely for each book, I want to give myself new artistic challenges and kind of open up some different avenues of exploration. And so even in my previous four books, even though the theme is all connected formally, they're very different. And so I think as you both know, being an artist, you always want to try new things and experiment. And so that's what I try to do with every new book and just keep it creative to stay engaged and to continue to grow as a writer and artist.
Yeah.
The book itself, it's a visual pleasure. I have to say, I really love just looking through the pages. Each page holds a different form, structure, feeling. For the listeners, this book includes a range of forms, which we've talked about a little bit earlier, but even things like just a graph on a page as a poem, the gray and black text color. Sometimes words have missing letters. So just visually interesting to me. And I would imagine ordering the poems in the book, including the visual as well as the subject matter, would be a challenge. So I was curious if you could talk about your process for putting the collection together.
Yeah, thank you. I love this kind of question. Yeah, each poem is quite different, both visually and thematically. And that, of course, you know, as I mentioned, keeps it fun and engaging. But it makes it very challenging to then order it as an entire collection. So, you know, like many other writers, what I did at first was to print out and just lay out all the poems on the floor and try to visualize it in that way. And then think about and experiment with different organizing ideas and structures. And so that was, you know, months and months of just playing around with order. And the final product was probably the fifth iteration of different order. And I even took out a lot of poems. So I think the first draft was about 100 pages, so maybe 20 more poems.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, but as I started putting them all together, you know, some poems maybe were too similar in form or repeated a theme that was in another poem or even repeated some kind of poetic technique. And so I kind of took some of those out. Some poems are, of course, not as strong as others, so I took those out as well. And so the final version is kind of what I felt were the strongest poems of that original group. And then finding an arc and structure was still pretty difficult. I landed on three sections. The first section is a lot of poems about my daughter being a new parent, feeling anxious about the world that she was inheriting and all the things that were happening. She was born in 2014, so a lot of these poems, you know, over the past 6 years, for anyone paying attention, were a lot of environmental disasters and climate change comes to the fore of our consciousness more so. Mm-hmm. The second section is more about relationship between humans and animals. And so I kind of saw that as a major theme I was working on. So I wanted to give that its own section. And then the third and final section kind of returns to, you know, human environmental issues, but the tone shifts a little bit where they're more humorous, sarcastic, satirical, parodic poems at the end. And so I kind of put that in its own section, as well as some other really large sweeping poems. And of course, a challenge is always finding the first poem and the last poem of a poetry book. Uh-huh. And so, you know, the first poem is literally a poem about my daughter's birth. So that made sense to start there. And the final poem is about the ocean. And to me, living, of course, in Hawaii and in the Pacific, felt like a natural place to end the book because the ocean is itself a metaphor for flow and connection. And, you know, so I thought that would be a nice way to end the journey of the book, so to speak.
Thank you for sharing that. I really love all the layers in your process and the physicality of it. I'm working in Scrivener when I write, and I'm just moving around things that way. But I can imagine like printing out the poems, having them laid out, looking at them, touching them, moving them. It's really great.
Yeah. Something that occurred to me when I was reading this book is, of course, then I actually, it's funny, when I really like a book, I read the end as well and the dedication. Like, I don't usually read that if I don't. Is that a terrible thing to admit? So I was reading the end of it, and I was very curious about how all of these poems came together. So that was like so interesting for me as well. But I was also thinking about the issue of many of these poems had homes prior to the book's publication. And so there's this long list, a lot of the poems that had already been published. And I know sometimes when I publish or when I have a collection of short stories published or something of that nature, they come from different eras or different times in my writing. And as you were looking at this big body of work that you had trying to cull from these various poems, I wondered, what is the lifespan of the poems in this book? Had you been writing these poems for years?
Yeah, so the oldest poem is from 2014. And I finished the book in 2019. So it's about a 5-year span. And as you read the book, you witness, you know, my daughter being born, and then she, you know, she grows up throughout the book. So there is interesting sense of the passing of time. And there's also a sense of deep time in the book, of course, when you talk about ecological issues or the Anthropocene that addresses kind of geological time spans. And so, you know, it was strange to come and start editing it all together in 2019. And some of my style had changed, of course, over 5 years. And so I was editing a lot of the older poems to kind of catch up in some ways with the newer stuff. And to be honest with you, if someone actually looked at where these poems were originally published, none of them are actually the same.
Wow.
Yeah. Even though they were published in journals and sometimes even really prestigious journals, I still kept editing it after that for this final book. And then also when I put the poems together, I'm like, wow, I repeat this word a lot over the past 5 years. And so I had to edit that because, you know, when the poem is published individually, you don't notice that. But when you put it all together, then you kind of see your tendencies. By itself, it's fine, but with all these other poems next to it, reader is going to notice that I keep using this technique or this literary device. And so I have to, you know, then the poems, you have to revise the poems in context to the other poems, which is an interesting process, I think.
Five years is a long time when you wrote the original poem to coming back to them. And yeah, I can imagine. And then trying to work them into the book with all the other poems, I'd have my editing pen out too, I think. I've read that you view your poetry books as poetic archives, and one of your aims as a poet is to bring the archive to your community and to the public. Can you talk a little bit more about this intentionality and if or how it has evolved with your most recent book?
Yes, great question. You know, I definitely feel that poetry has a pedagogical purpose as well as an activist purpose. And what I mean by that is people can read or listen to a poem and learn something. Moreover, they can read or listen to a poem and become politically engaged or inspired towards activism. And I've been really lucky that, you know, I kind of came of age around a lot of other poets who were involved with environmental and political activism, as well as, you know, of course, a lot of writers and poets are also educators. And so I got to see firsthand the role that poetry can play in the classroom and at a rally or protest movement. And one thing I love to do is also attending these kind of like climate march, for example, here in Hawaii. And at the end of the march, there's always speakers and musicians and painters. And, you know, I often will share my poetry at these events. And of course, similarly, I teach poetry. And so I could see in my students how they engage with the poem because it's creative and literary and kind of fun to play with language. But on the other side of that, and kind of undercover too, they're learning something about the environment. And so I think poetry and literature can be a creative gateway towards developing environmental literacy. And I love teaching eco-poetry, particularly because not only that, but then also have my students then will go do a beach cleanup after after reading a poem about plastic, learning about plastic pollution, then we're actually on the beach helping to address this issue. And so to me, that really kind of engages all aspects of what literature and the humanities in general can do, you know, for us individually, but also as a society.
Absolutely. Right.
Well, you know, relatedly or somewhat relatedly, I was thinking it would be very appropriate if there were an inaugural poet who was a conservationist at this time for the Biden administration. Did you ask there if maybe you could take that? No, I'm just kidding.
DC is a bit far from home for me.
Right now, but my real question here is, what do you think the effect of the Biden administration will be in terms of eco-conservation? Do you have any thoughts about that? What's coming next?
Yeah, it seems that Biden and his team has a really strong climate agenda, focused on renewable energies, protecting conservation lands, national parks, and really reducing carbon emissions, you know, whether it's through regulating industries like transportation or just moving away from fracking and offshore oil and stuff like that. And so, you know, I have a lot more hope than under the Trump administration, of course. But as we all know, too, the Democratic Party is very involved with the corporate agenda. And so, you know, I think environmentalists still have to push the Biden administration really hard towards the left and towards a more sustainable Green New Deal and a more progressive Green New Deal. But at least I think Biden and the Democrats is a party that can be encouraged more towards the left as opposed to the previous administration. So I feel hopeful and was very relieved when they were elected. And so I think we have a lot of work to do, and it's really urgent as we are running out of time. And so I think we got to just push as hard as we can and stay hopeful and committed to the struggle.
I agree. And undoing some of the damage is going to take time. And then, like you said, working towards more of a Green New Deal. Mm-hmm. So it's time. You mentioned something about how students would read your poetry and go collect plastic on the beach. And I was thinking about your poem, The Age of Plastic, which is really compelling with the text in gray and with the exception of the word plastic, which appears in black, giving it just so much attention. In the poem, you conflate the birth of your child with the birth life cycle of plastic. And I'm curious if you could talk about the idea, object, or metaphor of plastic as it's found in this poem. And just the idea of plastic, I think, is really interesting.
Yeah, so that was exactly what I was thinking about when I myself was learning about the issue of plastic pollution. And of course, here in the Pacific, you know, plastic not only washes up upon our beaches, but there is this large, you know, what they call the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, where all the plastic is accumulating in the oceans, which is north of Hawaii. And so the issue is very prevalent and disconcerting. And so when I was learning about this issue, my wife was pregnant at the time, and I started just seeing plastic everywhere, you know, not only as rubbish, but also just as in everything that we use. The hospital that we're going to is, of course, filled with plastic. Even as I mentioned in the poem, we had a home birth, and so my wife also put her placenta in a plastic bag in a Ziploc. And so I was like, oh my God, plastic is everywhere.
All of a sudden, you're seeing it everywhere.
Exactly, yeah. And I was really struck by this idea that I read, that plastic is the perfect creation, you know, because it never dies. And I was like, oh my God, that's such an interesting idea. And of course, people talk about how plastic never disintegrates. So that's why it stays in the oceans for so long. It never truly dies. It's going to be here millions of years from now within the geological record. And so I wanted to write a poem thinking about birth and death, about the ubiquity of plastic in our everyday lives. And then formally, I wanted to try to embody that idea in the visual elements of the poem. And that's when I started to think about the color of the font and just to fade into gray everything else, but keep plastic yeah. in a dark font. So it shows that even though the life, human life will fade away, the plastic remnants will still be there long after we're gone.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's horrible. I mean, it's horrible. It's horrible with all of those microplastic particles too. And the way that it's affecting the ocean is really bothering me. And speaking of something that has ocean in it, I really love the praise song for Oceana. Is that how you say that?
Yes.
And how there was this short film made by Justin Ah Chong from that poem. Can you speak to how that collaboration came about and just your experience with having a poem connected to a film?
Yes, I wrote that poem for World Oceans Day, which is it's an international event, but it's pretty important here in the Pacific Islands, of course. And so I wanted to write a poem that would praise the ocean, or what some call Oceania. And so I wrote this praise song and writing about all the different ways that the ocean gives birth to all things and how it sustains life, but also how it is very threatened and imperiled by us. And it's kind of a complex poem in the sense that the ocean is a very deep, profound, complex place. And so I wanted to capture all the different elements of the ocean. Now, of course, the ocean is also very visual, at least if you're surrounded by it or if you live on the coast. And so I wanted to team up with a filmmaker who is a friend of mine and who's actually really involved in environmental issues as well. He's part of this canoe here in Hawaii called the Hokulea, which is, it made history a few years ago by doing a worldwide voyage as a way to raise awareness about ocean issues. And he was actually one of the documentary filmmakers aboard the canoe. And so I knew he had a lot of amazing footage of the ocean. And so, yeah. And so I recorded the poem, just me reading it, and sent him the audio and gave him creative license to match the words to visuals that he found compelling. Wow. He made an awesome, it's like a 5-minute video, pretty short. And we're lucky that it's been accepted into film festivals around the world and a lot of environmental film festivals as well.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. And then it was actually featured on the United Nations World Oceans Day website.
Wow. You're so fancy.
So listeners can Google that and find it online. You can watch the video. It's really powerful. Justin did an amazing job. And, I think when you match these, any eco poetry to visuals, it's even more powerful because we're talking about the environment. And when you see nature, and not just reading words about nature, it just brings it to a whole new level. And so I'm grateful to him and grateful that the poem can be helped raise awareness about ocean issues through various media.
That's great. You have several recycling poems in the collection. In these poems, you recycle previously written poems, songs, or texts. For example, Christmas in the Capital Scene references Irving Berlin's I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas. What is your recycling method, and how does recycling art or words parallel other kinds of recycling?
Hmm. Yeah, thank you for this question. Those were some of the most fun.
I can't read that poem without singing it, though.
I know. I want to hear you sing it later after cocktail.
Deal.
When I was writing this book, I was thinking a lot about how climate change changes everything, to kind of allude to Naomi Klein's book. And it even changes the way we see the world, right? Mm-hmm. And, so I wanted to think about how it's even changing the way we read poetry. And so, of course, as a student and teacher of poetry, I'm often returning to famous poems in history to teach and to read. And gosh, every time I read some poem or even listen to a song like Irving Berlin's Christmas song, I just think about it in different ways. Like when I was listening to that song during one of the hottest Christmases in history, I'm just thinking about, oh my gosh, Christmas is changing. And in some ways, this song, like how I'm listening to this song, is changing. And even another poem I recycle, so to speak, is Wallace Stevens's famous 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird.
Right.
And that poem itself is all about perception and how we see things from different ways changes its meaning. And I started thinking about that in terms of glaciers, because at that time, there are all these documentaries coming out about glaciers and how we see glaciers and how they're disappearing, so we won't see them in a few years' time if things don't change. And so I wanted to kind of play with that idea and to revise / remix and ultimately recycle these poems, in the sense that I still keep their form. So the form and the syntax of the poems, the famous poems, are still the same, but I change the content, right? I change what's inside the form. And so to me, that speaks to, of course, the plasticity of poetry itself and of literature. The form can stay the same, right? The bottle can stay the same, but what's inside, the content of it, changes. And so I thought that was, to me, became a powerful way to think about both plasticity, recycling, and also literature and perception, and how in our era, we are seeing everything differently and everything is changing, including even poems that are 100 years old are totally different now when we see it through a new lens.
Interesting. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I noticed with the recycling of the This Is Just to Say poem of William Carlos Williams in particular, I think it creates almost a multi-layered type of listening for your reader as well, particularly your reader who already knows a lot of this poetry. Because in their mind, they're contrasting the plums and, for example, the burgers or the meat that you're referencing. And it makes that poem the more disturbing, right?
Plums become impossible burgers. That is very disturbing.
Yeah. So in my head, I'm like, I'm in the fridge, and then, oh no, I'm in the lab, and then I'm at the plums. Oh no, I'm at the, you know. So anyway, I'm hoping that you'll read at least a couple of these poems that we've been discussing. Here's another question. I want to know, when you're in the, you've mentioned a couple of times that you're involved in a pedagogical function, that you're teaching, that you're kind of spreading the gospel of poetry and environmentalism and poetry and ecopoetics and all of the other things that are so important to you as an author and as a human. When you're in the classroom, is there something you want most for all of your students to take away? Is there some lesson that you feel like you really bring into all of the classes that you teach?
That's a powerful question, especially during these times where most educators are working remotely. Definitely for me, I want, first and foremost, for my students to be creative and to fall in love with literature and poetry, and to really feel impassioned when they themselves write their own poems and share them in class. You know, so that's one aspect of it. You know, secondly, I want them to really deeply engage with the issues that poems address, whether it's culture, politics, ecology, or even food, which I teach a wonderful course on food poetry that I have a lot of fun with. And then I want students to realize that poetry isn't just for and within the classroom, but that poetry and literature is really for society and for community. And it's really meant to be out in the world and to inspire us to be more deeply engaged with the world. Whether that means, you know, something just like living more passionately your own life, or becoming involved with environmental and climate justice movements, or writing about racism and then becoming involved with anti-racist movements, which is really in the forefront of a lot of people's imaginations these days. And so that's really what I want to take away, to be creative, to fall in love, to know that they too are poets, and that this can be a nourishing part of their lives. And then to learn something about the world around us, and to then, you know, lastly, become deeply engaged with their own lives and with the society that they live.
Yeah.
Those are beautiful aspirations. I love that. Now, who are some of your favorite poets? Who do you like to read, or who are your influences as public intellectuals?
Since I moved to Hawaii, I've really been mostly engaged with Pacific Islander and Hawaiian poets. Mm-hmm. And so maybe I'll just say some Hawaiian poets that I love.
Okay. Yeah.
One is Haunani K. Trask, which is an amazing political writer. Another is Wayne Westlake, who does a lot of cool visual poetry. There's another writer named Joe Balaz, who writes in what we call here Hawaiian Pidgin. It's kind of a Creole English. Mm-hmm. And then finally, another writer named Brandy Nalani McDougall, who's actually a Hawaiian poet, but she uses a lot of formal traditional poetry, like sonnet, but using like Hawaiian language and Hawaiian themes.
That's awesome. I love hearing all of these poets, and particularly that I think our audience will hear some poets' names they haven't heard before. So that's exciting. Thank you. We're really looking forward to hearing you read an excerpt from Habitat Threshold. But before we do that, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book. And I'll let her tell us.
Well, our cocktail today is called a Deep Bluocene. And the recipe's on the blog if you want to make one and enjoy it while you listen at home. I'm getting mine ready right now. Here's what's in it. 2 ounces of gin, 1 ounce of triple sec, 1 ounce of blue curacao, and 2 dashes of bitters. I was waiting for now, and I'm having mine. Right?
Yes.
I know Heather started at the beginning. Okay, I'm ready.
Well, that cocktail sounds delicious. I'm going to have to write an ode to the Bluocene for my next book.
That would be wonderful.
Dedicated to both of you.
Great. Well, Craig, is there anything you'd like to tell us about the poems you're sharing today?
Well, I'm going to read 3 poems, and they all come from the first 2 sections of the book. And they kind of tie into what I mentioned earlier, themes of parenting and environmentalism. And the first is one that we've talked about called Age of Plastic. The doctor presses the plastic probe against my pregnant wife's belly. Plastic leaches estrogenic and toxic chemicals. Ultrasound waves pulse between plastic, tissue, fluid, and bone until the embryo echoes. Plastic makes this possible. My wife labors at home in an inflatable plastic tub. Plastic disrupts hormonal and endocrine systems. After delivery, she stores her placenta in a plastic freezer bag. Plastic is the perfect creation because it never dies. Our daughter sucks on a plastic pacifier. Whales, plankton, shrimp, and birds confuse plastic for food. The plastic pump whirls. Breast milk drips into a plastic bottle. Plastic keeps food, water, and medicine fresh. Yet, how empty plastic must feel. To be birthed, used, then disposed by us, degrading creators. In the oceans, 1 ton of plastic exists for every 3 tons of fish. How free plastic must feel when it finally arrives to the paradise of the Pacific gyre. Will plastic make life impossible? Our daughter falls asleep in a plastic crib, and I dream that she's composed of plastic, so that she, too, will survive our wasteful hands. So that's the first poem of the book. And the second poem is a few poems later, and actually takes place to when my daughter turned 1, and we had a big celebration for her, because in Hawaiian culture, the first birthday is a really important one. This poem is called Rings of Fire, takes place here in Honolulu, Hawaii. We host our daughter's first birthday party during the hottest April in history. Outside, my dad grills meat over charcoal. Inside, my mom steams rice and roasts vegetables. They've traveled from California, where drought carves trees into tinder. Paradise is burning. When our daughter's first fever spiked, the doctor said it's a sign she's fighting infection. Bloodshed surges with global temperatures which know no borders. If her fever doesn't break, the doctor continued, take her to the emergency room. airstrikes detonate hospitals in Yemen, Iraq, Afghanistan, South Sudan. When she crowned, my wife said, it felt like rings of fire. Volcanoes erupt along Pacific fault lines. Sweltering heat waves scorch Australia. Forests in Indonesia are razed for palm oil plantations. Their ashes flock like ghost birds to our distant rib cages. Still, I crave an unfiltered cigarette, even though I quit years ago and my breath no longer smells like my grandpa's overflowing ashtray. His parched cough still punctures the black lungs of cancer and denial. If she struggles to breathe, the doctor advised, give her an asthma inhaler. But tonight, we sing happy birthday and blow out the candles together. Smoke trembles as if we all exhaled the same flammable wish. This final poem comes from the second section, as I mentioned earlier, that addresses the relationship between human and animals. This poem is titled The Last Safe Habitat, and it's dedicated to a native Hawaiian bird called the Kauai O'o, whose song was last heard in 1987. The Last Safe Habitat. I don't want our daughter to know that Hawaii is the bird extinction capital of the world. I don't want her to walk around the island feeling haunted by tree roots buried under concrete. I don't want her to fear the invasive predators who slither, pounce, bite, swallow, disease, and multiply. I don't want her to see paintings and photographs of birds she'll never witness in the wild. I don't want her to imagine their bones in dark museum drawers. I don't want her to hear their voice recordings on the internet. I don't want her to memorize and recite the names of 77 lost species and subspecies. I don't want her to draw a timeline with the years each was first collected and last sighted. I don't want her to learn about the Kauai O'o, who was observed atop a flowering ohia tree, calling for a mate day after day, season after season, because he didn't know he was the last of his kind, until one day he disappeared forever into a nest of avian silence. I don't want our daughter to calculate how many miles of fencing is needed to protect the endangered birds that remain. I don't want her to realize the most serious causes of extinction can't be fenced out. I want to convince her that extinction is not the end. I want to convince her that extinction is just a migration to the last safe habitat on Earth. I want to convince her that our winged relatives have arrived safely to their destination, a wondrous island with a climate we can never change and a rainforest fertile with seeds and song.
Wow, that was so great. Such an honor to hear you read your work today. So much power in those poems. Thank you so much, Craig.
Thank you. Thank you for listening and, you know, for the opportunity to share the work with both of you, who had such, you know, such thoughtful questions and really profound readings of the book. And so thankful to share the poems with your audience as well.
Oh, it's so fun. I got to tell you, every time we have this podcast, it feels like such an honor and such a wonderful pleasure to have these intimate readings with authors and have them talking about what matters to them. So, can you tell us a little bit? Why don't you tell us about what's happening next? What do you imagine next in your publishing career?
Well, I have actually my next poetry book is coming out next year, and kind of returns to the previous series of books about my home island of Guam.
Wow.
And so I'll be finishing that up, final edits, this year. And during the pandemic, it's been difficult to write because I actually have two daughters now since writing some of those poems. And yeah, so they're both home from school because the schools are shut down. And my wife is also an educator, so we're both working from home. So haven't had as much time to write this past year. But when I have had snippets of time, I've been writing about the pandemic, about the connection between viruses and the environment. So it's kind of still eco-poetry, but more focus on microbiomes and virology and pandemics, you know, things that I had not been too familiar with beforehand. Mm-hmm. And I imagine, like a lot of people, we're just learning more about now. Yeah. And what's strange is that they're coming out as sonnets. Since we talked about form, and I think it's because I have a lot less time to write that, you know, the sonnet form is shorter and it feels more like portable in some ways. And then it's starting to feel like the sonnet is kind of a virus in some ways. It's kind of a viral form. It spreads to everybody, every poet, and infects us in different ways.
Right.
Yeah. And the symptoms of it, even though they're the Volta and the 14 lines, it's all the same symptoms, but it shows in different poems in different ways. And so anyways, that's kind of what I'm working on. Those two projects. We'll see how everything turns out this year. Hopefully this year will be more vaccinated and hopeful year than last year.
Yeah, and give everybody more creative space to work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, on the environmentalist tip, I have to say I've been fascinated by the pandemic news about what's happening with animals. Mm. You know, animals coming into communities they weren't comfortable in before. You know, more roaming through the metropolis, so to speak.
Yeah, great point.
And like a reduction in pollution as a result to economical downturns, and India, when the people are having to go out deeper into the waters where they look for crabs and all of this sort of thing, and now are being attacked by tigers. You know, so there's all of this kind of amazing fodder for environmentalist writing related to what's happening, connected to the pandemic. Do you know anybody who's doing anything like that? I've been craving reading something like that. So.
Yes, there's been several anthologies already published about poets writing about the pandemic. And it's been really interesting to read poets' responses to these times because everyone is experiencing it in such different ways. For myself, my wife and oldest daughter have asthma, and so we've been very safe and sheltering in place most of the time. So my experience has been very domestic and insular, but I know other people have been much more engaged with the world and outside and attending protests during the summer or, you know, during the elections. And of course, it's different around the world, right? Hawaii has been really impacted by the pandemic, but other islands in the Pacific have been able to close their borders, and some of them had no cases so far. And so that global aspect of the pandemic, I think, is really interesting. And I will be curious to see how not only poets, but novelists and playwrights like you both, short story writers too, are going to be writing about these times.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a question. What advice would you offer to new poets who are learning maybe on their own outside of an academic context?
Well, I think definitely read as much as you can. And what's good now is that there's so much free poetry online. And mm-hmm. so if you're struggling financially, it's if you have an internet connection, you can access so much poetry. And, you know, I think by reading, then you learn a lot of techniques on your own. You learn a lot of different styles, different forms. And so once you feel full with reading and then get to that journal as soon as possible or to your laptop and just start writing and just be creative, be open and experiment, and don't feel too much pressure about publishing or what anyone's going to think about it. Just let yourself connect with the poem and let the poem guide you, and let it be a space for exploration and healing and philosophy or whatever you might be interested in. And, you know, and then share it. Read it to your friends, post it on social media, go to, well, nowadays, virtual open mics, not actual open mics. And yeah, just fall in love with it and let it be an important part of your life.
That's great advice. I really love the idea of being full with reading.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I have one last question for you, Craig. Mm-hmm. With so many accolades for your work, so many different things that you do, and, you know, between your academic pursuits, your environmentalism, your poetry, your editing, your all of the things that you do, what honor, award, or collaboration has really been the most meaningful to you?
Oh, wow. Well, thank you, first of all. Probably the most meaningful was a collaboration I did with the Guam Humanities Council back in 2010. And it was most meaningful because I grew up on Guam, a very small island. But when I was 15 years old, my family decided to migrate to California, like many others, kind of looking for better opportunities. And I finished high school in California and went to college and learned how to drive, which was terrifying. And I was never able to afford to go back to Guam because the plane tickets were so expensive. It's about a 12-hour flight from San Francisco. And so 15 years passed before I was able to return home. And the reason why I was able to return home was because the Guam Humanities Council brought me back. In 2010, wow. my second book was just published, and they wanted me to come home to, you know, have a book launch in my homeland, and then also to visit the public high schools and the university and community college, and then to do several community readings to be able to kind of inspire the youth, of course, but then also to create a space for the community to engage with some of the political and environmental topics in my book. Uh-huh. Yeah, and so that was like, I had been away from home for 15 years. And during that time, I was writing poetry about home, and poetry ended up being the thing that would bring me back home eventually. And so being back home for the first time in 15 years, seeing relatives again, and then connecting with, you know, the high school students especially, was such an inspiring and empowering event, and really deeply rooted my own belief that literature can bring people together, and that it is such an important part of culture and of education and of civic conversation. That really, you know, in the 10 years since that, that's kind of, that event and collaboration has really still lit the fire within me every time I approach the blank page or have a new book coming out. And so, yeah, thank you for that question. I hadn't thought about that before, but I appreciate reminiscing for a moment.
No, thank you. I feel like we just took a little journey. I was getting all verklempt when you were talking. I was like, oh, this is so moving. And, you know, it's like you're bringing what you love to the home and giving us this kind of little lens into being coming from where you are. So that was just such a nice thing. Thank you. So amazing. Thank you for spending time with us at Book Tales today. We enjoyed talking with you and hearing you read your work. And everybody out there, please order Craig's book, Habitat Threshold, and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the Book Tales readings and drinks for this podcast series. Subscribe to this podcast series, which releases once a month, for more conversation with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales.